Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Affirmative action. The Supreme Court, in hearing a presentation by two different cases, Students for Fair Admissions Incorporated versus the President and Fellows of Harvard, and the same organization, Students for Fair Admissions versus the University of North Carolina, introduces again the history of affirmative action. And before that, we reach back to the Civil War period because it begins with the 14th Amendment. I learned from Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution. He teaches law at the University of Chicago and NYU, Writing and Defining Ideas. Richard, you present this as an historical momentum reaching back to the 19th century. So before we come to the prospects of the court, the present court, I want to start in 1868 and the 14th Amendment, because you identify that as critical, as making what you'd say the original error that needed to be corrected over the next 100 years. The word is protection. What was the error there that either the lawmakers didn't understand or later was useful to the adversaries of tolerance?
Yeah, well, it's a very important question. The government in this world does two things. One is what it does is it takes things from you. And the other thing that it does is it gives things to you. And the question is, what does the Protection Clause cover? And the answer seems to have been historically that they were worried about the enforcement of the criminal law, and they wanted to deal with questions of differential enforcement. They wanted to make it clear that if you were a black person, you could not be subject to more severe sanctions, and that if you were a white person, you could not get off. So essentially, whether you were plaintiff or defendant, they wanted to make this thing race neutral. To this very day, there is nobody, I think, who seriously opposes that particular notion and says that when it comes to burglary charges, we give heavy punishment to blacks or to whites. But the other thing that the government does is it gives things away. In 1868, it was 40 acres and a mule to the freed slaves. And the question was whether or not the same restrictions that you place on protection is placed on donation. Historically, the answer was no. And that what happened is the government had a very large discretion in the way in which it decided to dispense its goodies. This is a very unstable situation because the only thing realistically that the government could dispense is the stuff that it raises by taxes. And if taxes are regarded as coercion and you take taxes from everybody and you consciously give those tax dollars to only a fraction of the population, it's a kind of theft. And so what happens is you have to figure out then how you apply the Equal Protection Clause to government grants. So to take a very simple case, it's the South, the year is 1920, and white teachers in white schools get a salary of $1,000, and black teachers in black schools get a salary of $600. And that's clearly a massive shift of wealth from one group to another. And the issue is, does the Equal Protection Clause reach these public transfers? And the answer that was reached quite painfully with a period of time is yes, it turns out that we cannot run this system coherently if the only thing that we do is to deal with the protection side and give the government free rein on the distribution side. And so when you got the Brown v. Board of Education, what they said is segregation has, quote unquote, no place under the Constitution. It was a very thinly reasoned opinion, which gave rise to all sorts of political uneasiness. There was a Southern movement of massive resistance. There was a famous article by Herb Wexler, a distinguished professor from Columbia Law School, who said, I'm not sure this follows neutral principles. But in the end, Brown won out because what happens is it's a totally impermissible way of the government doing business. And as you then start to move forward, the political balance starts to change. And all of a sudden, you get to the affirmative action question as to whether or not you could do the redistributions the opposite direction.
I want to introduce now Title VI. It was adopted in 1964. Title VI is also the federal government's understanding of fairness, of tolerance. And you have a statement from John Kennedy. And the quote is, simple justice requires that public funds to which all taxpayers of all races contribute not be spent in any fashion which encourages, entrenches, subsidize, or results in racial discrimination. We come immediately to 1978 in the Supreme Court, Regents of the University of California versus Bakke. This is the famous Bakke case. What is the gap between 64 and Title VI and President Kennedy's statements and the Bakke decision?
Okay, well, Kennedy made that statement, obviously, in 1963, but it certainly represented the dominant sensibilities that everybody had in passing the Civil Rights Act. It was self-consciously designed as a statute which was to institute a colorblind regime on the distribution side, as it was on the protection side. And the theory at the time was that we would grow out of segregation once we had equal opportunity through education and everything else. Right after the bill was passed, indeed even before it was passed, the riots start. And they're everywhere. They're in Newark. They're in New York. They're in Los Angeles. They're in Washington. They're in Detroit. It just goes on and on. And there were many people who started to think very clearly about this situation. They said, you know, we can't wait 20 years to get parity. We know there are a lot of things that have gone wrong here. And so what you then did is you started to say what we need to do is to repair the harm, restorative justice, and have some affirmative action programs to offset the deficits. And then there was a second rationale, independent of that, which said, oh, no, no, what we need is diversity, which, again, is a form of affirmative action, to make sure that these are better institutions in the way in which they run. And then in the Bakke case, what you do is you have a very anguished Justice Powell who's sitting there with 4-4, one yes, one no on the side, trying to figure out what to do. And he says, you know, in his own mind, he just thinks it's too rigid to say that you can't do anything. So you've got to be able to do a little bit of something. And he kind of puts himself down on the diversity side of the situation or the rectification side. You're never quite sure which. But as time has gone on, the rectification side for past justices seems to have petered out. Segregation ended 60, 70 years ago, depending on where you look. The diversity issues in the here and now. If you just look with respect to segregation, it turns out it's just a black-white issue. When you look at the modern situation, there are many other people who've come into the play, the American Indians, the Asian population, all different varieties thereof. It's just an extremely complicated situation. And so what we do is we have a new doctrine which recognizes that the old system was not very good. And it wasn't. It was much too rigid. But then you can figure out, A, what the new system should look like, and B, what its rationale should be. So just to put it in one sentence, our friend Powell was a small incrementalist. He realized that you can't have the rigid rule, and he was trying to open the door a little bit. The door is now swung wide open. The gaps that you see in terms of the admissions policies in both public and private universities have become enormous, and some people now have the following really very uneasy situation. Either you open it all the way, or you can't open it at all because we can't keep the drawer ajar. And that's the problem that you're facing now.
We come to the Grutter case. This is 2003, Grutter versus Bollinger. You write that that was a crystallization of the Bakke case. How so? What did it result in, and in terms of diversity in admission?
Well, what it did is, in effect, is it certainly allowed these programs to start to take place. And so essentially what it is, you could now use race as a plus factor. The issue is how big a plus factor it was not addressed. Justice O'Connor was a very profound incrementalist and somebody who wrote in immense good faith. And she has a famous passage in there, the two of them that are worth mentioning. One is, who was in favor of these programs? And they got very powerful briefs from both government military types on the one hand and from corporate CEOs, both of whom said, and I think rightly, we cannot run our particular institutions on a pure colorblind basis. We have to be able to give some slack on this situation. And for her to see major public institutions support some form of affirmative action was absolutely decisive in her thinking. She said, we've got to do this. Well, what is the it that we have to do? And her view was, and it's a famous sentence, in 20 years from now, this program will largely disappear, because she had the same view that education over time would lead to these particular improvements. And it's now 19 years, and it hasn't happened yet, and it's not going to happen. Indeed, what's happened is the critical race theory has completely changed the terms.
We now come to the SFFA case, and it puts two questions to the court. I'll read them, Richard. You link them in your piece of defining ideas. One, should this court overrule Grutter versus Bollinger and hold that institutions of higher education cannot use race as a factor in admissions? Two, Title VI of the Civil Rights Act bans race-based admissions that, if done by a public university, would violate the Equal Protection Clause. Is Harvard violating Title VI by penalizing Asian American applicants, engaging in racial balancing, overemphasizing race, and rejecting workable race-neutral alternatives? Those are the questions put by the court. And help me, Richard, the mechanics of this. The court has accepted to answer those questions. Is that correct?
Yeah, this whole thing is right up on the bubble. And I mean, I know everybody is very, very nervous. So if you have to understand that when you're running a major university, these are large ships and you can't turn them immediately within the waters. There is no question, if you look at the North Carolina situation, look at the Harvard situation, or just look, for example, at the stated programs that take place in places like California and so forth, that some heavy form of diversity, now often called equity and inclusion and belonging, is a very essential part of the way in which modern universities conceive of themselves, whether you like this or not. If you were to basically say that all of this stuff is now wholly out of bounds and force people to find some kind of neutral proxies, two things are going to happen. The transitions costs are going to be absolutely very, very high for everybody involved. And the substitute mechanisms that you're going to find are only going to be partial palliatives for the condition that you think you have to remedy. So if you're a strong supporter of these kinds of programs, you face now a kind of nervous panic, both because of the mechanical tasks that you have to do and the complete makeover in the way in which your business is going to have to take place. And so all of a sudden, the people who champion judicial interventions to override segregation are now deeply suspicious of judicial intervention when it wants to override critical race theory. It's amazing how people's views on the relative roles of the courts and the legislatures and private parties tend to take to change shape depending upon the substantive view that they have of any given issue.
Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, writing most recently at Defining Ideas about questions before the Supreme Court right now. And when we come back, I also learned from Richard that these questions have been, over these last years, made part of the academic way of hiring people. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is Matt Rogers from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
This is Bowen Yang from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
Hey, Bowen, it's gift season.
Ugh, stressing me out. Why are the people I love so hard to shop for?
Probably because they only make boring gift guides that are totally uninspired. Except for the guide we made.
In partnership with Marshalls, where premium gifts meet incredible value.
It's giving gifts! With categories like best gifts for the mom whose idea of a sensible walking shoe is a stiletto.
Or best gifts for me that were so thoughtful I really shouldn't have.
Check out the guide on Marshalls.com.
And gift the good stuff at Marshalls.
Moro Casino. American Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. American Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
At CVS, it matters that we're not just in your community, but that we're part of it. It matters that we're here for you when you need us, day or night. And we want everyone to feel welcomed and rewarded. It matters that CVS is here to fill your prescriptions and here to fill your craving for a tasty and, yeah, healthy snack. At CVS, we're proud to serve your community because we believe where you get your medicine matters. So visit us at CVS.com or just come by our store. We can't wait to meet you. Store hours vary by location.